Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as usual. First, in a few minutes, very few, since these interviews are pretty long, we'll hear from Carrie Lane, who has a new book out about her research into how unemployed high-tech workers think about their idleness and their larger careers. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, on an array of topics, including what's wrong with Rachel Maddow, the problems of spontaneity in politics, and the limits of race and racism as analytical and political categories. A quick word about politics and demographics. As my first guest says in her book, most tales about neoliberalism coming out of the left, like David Harvey's or even Naomi Klein's, are about how powerful elites do things to the poor. There's little examination of how people in the middle think or feel. That's true of a lot of left politics. It's about things that the rich do to the poor, and the vast middle, meaning 75% of the population, sort of disappears. While I can understand the attention to the poor, life can be very nasty, brutish, and short when you have no money, whether it's in the city or the country. The only hope for a better politics is getting some traction among that vast middle, who, while not desperate, are plagued by material insecurities. And talk of imposition, by shock or fiat, occludes just how elites are able to obtain the consent of the governed. The broad middle have the numbers and agency to change things, at least in potential. We may not like how they think, but we really need to pay closer attention than we do. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Carrie Lane.
There is history in this place. There are dragons to be chased. And though I don't know who you are, easy flow and a strong heart, and the charm in the way you hide, gently take my scar.
I've been reliving the 90s indie rock era, so I thought I'd share some of it with you. That was Sebado during a bit of Skull from the 1994 album Bake Sale. More indie gems later in the hour. My first guest is Carrie Lane, who teaches American Studies at Cal State Fullerton. She's just out with a book, A Company of One, from Cornell University Press. It's a report of her research into how high-tech workers in Dallas view unemployment and their larger careers. Though her subjects are all men, as she says in the interview, she heard similar things from women. Her work offers a profound insight into why Americans are not rebelling despite persistently high unemployment and other economic misery. They basically think that security is for wimps and you're on your own in this world. Carrie Lane. You did your research in Dallas, which people normally don't think of as a particularly high-tech sector. It certainly doesn't have the reputation of Silicon Valley or even Austin. Why did you pick Dallas as your focus?
You know, I initially decided to study Dallas in part because the existing research on the high-tech industry and high-tech workers tended to focus very heavily on Silicon Valley, and then there was some good research being done on North Carolina and Boston, but there was less research done on cities where high-tech was a strong presence, but not necessarily the defining industry of the area.
And as a result, were the people different? Texas, of course, very conservative, very Republican broadly, and you'd think more manly and more individualistic. Did that affect your research at all, as far as you can tell?
As far as I can tell, there were a few ways in which being in Dallas specifically did affect it, and I think that comes out more in some of the religious trends that I see playing out in networking events. But the individuals I interviewed themselves, most were transplants from elsewhere. They split pretty evenly politically along Democratic and Republican lines, with a few independents and libertarians tossed in the middle. And I actually found that in reading about research in other regions and talking to high-tech workers from other areas, that Dallas wasn't as idiosyncratic as you might expect in these respects, certainly not around the individualism and the way that sort of machismo factored into things.
But Dallas was relatively new as a high-tech center, wasn't it, at that point?
I mean, the high-tech focus in Dallas started out with manufacturing following World War II, and then you had the explosion of computing and technology companies around the defense industry. And those established themselves in sort of a telecom corridor that ran through Dallas and then into neighboring cities of Plano and Richardson. And as those large companies like Texas Instruments set up, they ended up with a lot of smaller spin-off companies around them. So there was already a computing presence, but not necessarily the dot-com image that we associate with Silicon Valley and Austin. That came later, and it never really did take off in Dallas as much as it did in other regions.
Now, to turn to your research, you landed in Dallas as the dot-com bubble was bursting and a bunch of people were laid off. You would think that that a lot of people who've been laid off after very high expectations would be in the depths of despair, but that's not precisely what you found, is it?
Absolutely, Doug. That's not at all what I found. In fact, I found, I don't want to say the opposite, but close. I initially didn't even set out to study unemployment. I was interested in looking at corporate cultures following the dot-com crash. You know, what had happened to this much lauded, casual, anti-hierarchical dot-com culture after the crash. And as I went to professional networking events, I ended up meeting individual after individual who was actually looking for work, who was there trying to network into a job. And having read the literature, especially on white-collar, male middle-class workers and unemployment, they weren't what I expected. They were relatively sanguine about their layoff. Many had been laid off before and bounced right back. They were very optimistic, had very little anger or blame for the people who had let them go, either the individual managers or the corporations. And that's when I became fascinated and realized that the bigger story about high-tech work at that moment was going on outside of corporations, not inside them.
Now, how has this changed over time? Because back in the 80s was when the brunt of the layoffs was being borne by the blue-collar workers. As you point out, a lot of people in the professional managerial class thought, well, you know, they got kind of what they deserve. The world is changing. And then, you know, as we went into the early 90s, there's a recession that really hit white-collar workers far more severely than they had in the past. And that was the time, the angry white man, as I recall. There's even a movie about that. Is this cultural memory borne out by any actual research?
Actually, it is. I mean, there is some good research. Catherine Newman's work is one example of this. She did ethnographic studies of downward mobility, and one part of her book, Falling from Grace, focused on downwardly mobile managers. And she really does bear out the idea that while there is a real faith in individualism there, there was also a lot of rage at companies, a real sense of betrayal by corporations that, at least in theory, had promised that the reward for loyalty, tenure, and hard work was going to be professional security and constant progression up the corporate ladder.
But now it seems like almost the ethic of the stock market has now pervaded human relations in every sense. Like, there's a saying that you don't marry a stock, and now these men you interviewed say you don't marry a job. There's a sense it's all a very, very temporary relationship. No one hooks up for very long with an employer now.
Absolutely. One of the individuals I spoke with, Enrique Vivar, you know, described work explicitly as a marriage of convenience. You know, he says, I'm not loyal anymore to a corporation, and I know that they're not loyal to me. And that was taken not necessarily as a good or a bad thing, but simply as the nature of the status quo. This was the way things are nowadays, and that workers had to accept that, stop looking for loyalty or job security from one corporation, and to embrace instead a very different model of what their careers were going to look like and what the best steps were to take to achieve success in their career.
So how do they think of their career architecture?
Their career as a collectivity, sort of a continuing series of short-term jobs. So even a job that technically speaking, would be a long-term permanent position, they say you've got to see every job as a contract. Always be looking for the next job. Always keep your network up to date. Always keep your resume polished and stay on top of trends in your industry, whether that means keeping an eye on what companies are growing or constantly retraining in new fields, getting new certifications, so that there's never that moment where you're able to sort of relax into a particular job. I mean, they do take great pride in doing well, in performing well at the jobs that they're in, but they see those as temporary. And they actually expect that there are going to be bouts of unemployment in their professional careers and that they'll also do some contract work and some consulting work, perhaps periods of entrepreneurship where they start out their own businesses, and that all of this jumbled together equals job security, as opposed to the old model where we saw job security as connected to staying in one position for your career.
And they look with scorn almost on people who expect something more permanent and more stable, don't they?
Absolutely. That was one of the most interesting parts of the research for me. The ways in which today's job seekers actually converted what we would see as the stigma of unemployment into a declaration of independent manhood, and that's where the title of my book, A Company of One, comes from. Because these workers, who I refer to as career managers, believe that expecting job security from a corporation is actually a very childish and dependent way of looking at work. And they think that if all you're doing is looking for your next job, then you're a sucker, and you're setting yourself up to be a victim of corporations. So instead, they fashion themselves as independent, forward-thinking companies of one who are actually equal entities with corporations on the competitive playing field. And that's where that marriage of convenience comes in. They say, you know, I'm going to partner up with a corporation as long as it's good for me, and they're going to partner up with me as long as it's good for them. And when one of us is no longer interested, then we're both going to go our separate ways.
Well, I remember back about the time you were doing this research, almost 10 years ago, that Tom Frank was writing books making fun of a lot of management consultants who were saying things very much like what your research subjects were saying. It made it sound then like this was just propaganda being spewed by a very out-of-touch elite, but actually they've internalized a lot of it, haven't they?
Absolutely, and I think there is... There are some who have the inclination to dismiss the people I'm talking to and their worldview, the way they see the world around them, as just corporate dupes of the capitalist system, who are either too privileged to see what's going on below them or who have bought in too much to this managerial ideology. But I think that's too easy an answer. I think there's something between corporate dupe and autonomous free agent that we can look at in a more nuanced fashion.
Well, you could argue that they don't really have much choice. I mean, they either have to adapt to this system or suffer one way or the other.
I would definitely agree with that. There aren't a lot of alternative ways of looking at the situation that are available, either in terms of when we look around at popular culture, when you think a lot of these individuals had business degrees, MBAs, or at least a lot of experience in the managerial world. And that managerial thought process is very powerful. The idea that you are the master of your own destiny, that job security is in fact infantilizing, and so corporations do you a favor by laying you off and not managing your career in the way that was once part of a human resources department's responsibilities.
You know, in a previous life, I studied Ralph Waldo Emerson rather closely, and I was struck by how ancient this American theme of self-reliance is. You're really responsible for yourself, and don't go whining to others.
Oh, it absolutely is. There's a long history of that. And there's one job search site, online job board for job seekers, that talks about contractors as the frontier folk of modern America, right? That they are on the frontier. And you hear this language employed a lot, this sort of cowboy individualism that has a healthy dose of machismo running through it. And the idea that being an individual is quintessentially American, and that we all are, or at least should strive to be, the masters of our own destiny. And the appeal of that thought process is obvious, right? It's a real source of finding pride and self-esteem and agency in a difficult time. And in many ways, it cushions the emotional and psychological blow of job loss, of prolonged unemployment, and of the frustrations of the job search. But as I argue in A Company of One, it really comes with an additional set of risks, because it is one way of viewing the world, and it obscures other equally, if not more compelling ways of understanding what's going on with insecure employment today and what costs that system has for individuals and for American society.
I'm speaking with Carrie Lane, who's the author of A Company of One, just out from Cornell University Press. But let's step back in time a bit. You point out that when what we think of as the old model of the permanent job for the white-collar worker was established, that corporations had to bribe men into thinking that that what they were doing is kind of manly. It required lots of fringe benefits to get them to step away from self-employment into that kind of what is now seen as old-fashioned dependent corporate employment.
Yes, there's a great work by a historian named Clark Davis called Company Men, and he explores how in early Los Angeles at the turn of the century, corporations were desperately trying to get white-collar, middle-class, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male workers to work for them. And because they had artificially narrowed the playing field by excluding women, members of the working class, immigrants, and non-Anglo-Saxons, they had a very small pool. And so these men were hopping back and forth in these early white-collar positions, just lobbying to get the best pay that they could, and didn't have any strong sense of corporate loyalty. So corporations had to sort of come together and think, okay, how are we going to create corporate loyalty? And they tried a bunch of different options, but one of those was by creating the corporate ladder to convince these men who, in the 19th century at least, the only way to be a successful middle-class man was to ultimately own your own business. You have to convince that guy that working for someone else for your entire career is not only okay, but is evidence of your intellect, your hard work, and your manly success. And they did that with pensions and cost sharing, by inventing the corporate ladder so you could constantly be moving up with masses of people below you. And it was very effective. In fact, it was so effective that then in the late 1970s, 1980s, when corporations start laying off white-collar workers by the tens of thousands ultimately, they have to undo the work they all too successfully did of convincing people that they had a right and an invested interest in sticking with one company for life.
But despite this talk of manliness, it seems like a lot of the men you interviewed did not really feel it was a terrible blow to their manliness to be supported by their wives during their period of layoff.
No, not at all. And I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even notice this early on in the research. It was such a natural part of the conversations where a lot of the – I spoke with women as well, but just as in the field of high tech and in the Dallas job-seeking market more generally, it's primarily male. Many of the men I spoke with would mention how grateful they were to their wives for the emotional financial support they provided. And it was only when I was speaking with one man named Ed Donnelly, and Ed was mentioning he had been unemployed for at least a year at that point from a programming job, and he said that thankfully his wife, who had also lost her job, had found a new one and was supporting the family, the two of them and their grown son. And Ed said, I think that's great because unlike a lot of guys, I don't mind relying on my wife for support. And the way he framed that as sort of an implicit critique of those insecure guys who wouldn't be okay with this and that he is sort of a feminist, forward-thinking man who's okay with that, that was very new. And that's where I realized that one of the major differences between these managers in the 80s, that model of the movie Falling Down, of the raging, angry white male who's lost his job, that just didn't fit anymore. And part of that is because half of all married couples in America have two earners. So one of those people can lose their job and you can still pay the mortgage and put food on the table, which is not to say there weren't real financial hardships that happened for these individuals, but it is very different. And these men were able to say, you know what, I'm not a provider and she's not a dependent. We have a partnership model of marriage, and so each person contributes what they can when they can. And they were able to refashion that dependence as actually evidence of how powerful their relationship was, of how strong their marriage was, and of what a forward-thinking, open-minded man they were.
You talked to men in high tech. I was wondering, as I was reading this, if you had talked to women or more working-class guys or people working in different industries, do you think the results would be very different, or is this kind of consciousness typical of this industry, or is it men in this industry, or is it broader than that?
Well, I guess I'd answer that in two ways. First, I did speak to women and women who were in similar middle-class, high-tech positions. And most of what I found was identical for women, this sense of how to manage your career, this idea that loyalty was dead and that one had to be constantly strategically positioning oneself for the next position. That was the same. I did find that women had slightly different ideas about dependence. They were, surprisingly, they were in fact far more upset about the idea of depending on a spouse or partner than were the men. The men could sort of refashion it in this new modern feminist way, whereas the women just felt like, I've established myself as a professional woman, and when I lose that job, I risk just becoming some sort of stereotyped female dependent in a way that I think unfortunately has been stigmatized in contemporary American culture. But then the second part of that would be I didn't actually study workers who are in other industries or workers who are within high tech but in lower status and lower paid occupations. However, the research that I've seen really suggests that in some ways these high-tech workers are at the forefront of what's going to become a more and more common way of thinking about work. High-tech is characterized by high job turnover, by the speedy obsolescence of technologies and of workers, a real focus on youth and newness. But the constant job change that once just characterized fields like high tech is now common across white-collar markets. I mean, I think the statistics are that most individuals will now have at least a dozen different jobs in their life, and that's almost twice as high when you look at people who are right now in their 20s and 30s. At least that's what the predictions say. So I think in some ways these workers, although their experiences are unique, they're canaries in the mine for what lies ahead, both pragmatically and ideologically, for white-collar workers in a whole variety of fields. I think this is what we're going to see in terms of the layoffs and job insecurity, and also in terms of the way they think about it. I think we're going to see that more and more in American culture.
Now, did you have any sense of whether this stance was to some degree a psychological defense, or that they're actually suffering more under the surface than they let on?
I definitely think that there's validity to that point. I mean, it clearly is a psychological defense. This is a difficult time, and people are looking for ways to reposition themselves and to get together that sense of self-esteem and optimism that everyone knows you need when you're looking for a job, right? You can't be discouraged and still be out there. Although I would argue that optimism, self-esteem, all of that still doesn't make you the master of your own destiny. But so there is some element of that. But most of the people I spoke with, I knew for periods of years. I spent almost 4 years in the field, knew most of these people that entire time, re-interviewed them multiple times, and then contacted them again 5 years later in 2009 to find out how things were going. And the depths of relationships we established lead me to believe that what they said was what they felt, at least over time. And that's not to say there weren't periods of depression and discouragement. Almost everyone I spoke with experienced those. What was interesting is that they saw that as a natural response, but an illogical one, right? Many of these are engineers, so it was dismissed as illogical and as unproductive. So they invoked Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying and said that, you know, anger is one of them, but you've got to get past it. And so they saw it as an impediment to being a good career manager, a good job seeker, to get stuck in that zone. And they actually worked very aggressively to avoid depression. Many cited research about exercise and volunteering as key to avoiding depression, especially during unemployment. And so I had job seekers who lost 30 or 40 pounds after being laid off because they made it to the gym, who ran triathlons, marathons, who volunteered in a whole variety of arenas, sometimes volunteering just because it was a cause that mattered to them, and sometimes volunteering because that was cited across the board as a great way to network into a new position, to meet people you might not otherwise come across.
The instability of employment is a product of a social arrangements. This is not a force of nature. We could do things differently if we'd so decided. But most of the guys you talked to were not really interested in the political analysis or any kind of political approach to these problems. It was all this kind of individual self-reliant approach, right?
Yes, they were absolutely disinterested in political action, collective activism, any form of protest against corporations or against government policies. I really see this as emblematic of what Henry Giroux has identified as the culture of anti-politics in America. He says Americans today see calls for change as futile, and they really dismiss out of hand any language of critique, instead turning entirely to individual agency. And when I asked them about labor movements, collective action, things like that, they tended to have a very ahistorical view of workers' rights in that they said labor unions were once effective, especially for blue-collar workers, but that they weren't effective nowadays. And many of the benefits they did enjoy, unemployment benefits, compensation upon leaving corporations, COBRA, things like this, health care that they could purchase, all of these things which were the product of other people's political activism, they saw as natural and status quo. And yet when asked about how things might change, they were unable to articulate anything but individual responses. In fact, one man said, you know, we're up against this thing, but we can't even see what this thing is. And on labor unions, I thought one of the most telling examples was an individual who's now in his early 60s and has essentially involuntarily retired after 9 years out of high tech. He had a series of hourly jobs and never made it back into high tech and has since retired. And he dismissed labor unions for white-collar workers, said that I can negotiate for myself better than any union ever could. And yet, objectively looking at his situation, it's fascinating to see that as he sees it, he has negotiated effectively for himself, or at least that he could have.
So this is a good explanation of why, despite high and persistent unemployment, Americans are not out on the streets the way they are in Western Europe.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, there are a lot of cultural commentators. Barbara Ehrenreich had a great editorial in the LA Times where she asks, why aren't people out there? And a lot of what I'm talking about is what she identifies as part of the problem, this idea that looking for a job is my new job, and distracting the unemployed with promises that anything but optimism and forward-thinking perspective is going to prevent you from getting a job. It really makes collective activism invisible, right? And the few times that the idea of collectively objecting to layoffs, of trying to fight for more rights for unemployed workers as a group, or of identifying as sort of a class of unemployed workers, those were rejected out of hand, usually. And it was interesting to see how uncomfortable those suggestions often made people, because as comforting as this individualist ideology can be, there are moments when it slips and when you will see job seekers get angry and get frustrated and adopt the sort of mindset that I think would lead one to take to the streets as we see in Europe. And yet they quash it right back down and say, no, that's irrational and counterproductive. I need to focus on what I can do.
That was Carrie Lane, a professor of American Studies at Cal State Fullerton and author of A Company of One, a very fine and important book just out from Cornell University Press. That comment on unions that she quoted at the end of the interview sounds a lot like the things that women workers at Walmart told my wife, Liza Featherstone, for her book Selling Women Short, which is all about the sex discrimination lawsuit against the mega retailer. One woman, who'd been passed over for raises and promotion for a decade, in other words, totally screwed, nonetheless said that she didn't need a union because she can take care of herself. Lane's subjects were men in the professional managerial class. Liza interviewed working-class women. But the similarities in their thinking are striking. You can't overestimate the role of self-reliant individualism in American life. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We'll be back to hear from Adolph Reed after this musical break. We'll be right back. More classic indie rock, that was some of Silkworm doing Quicksand for the 1996 album Firewater. My next guest is Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. There's no news hook for the interview, just a wide-ranging chat with one of the sharpest thinkers on politics around. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. Let's just start by considering a TV personality. You've had your doubts about Rachel Maddow, huh?
Yeah, I gotta say, well, I've had my doubts about the whole, you know, about the whole MSNBC thing, of course, as I know you have as well. And I've been toying with, you know, lately with writing a little piece that, you know, either title or first line of which would be, Rachel Maddow is not our constituency, nor is she the route to it, which I think I'm probably going to open my talk up to the California Faculty Association tomorrow night with. But I think it's telling. I mean, I haven't been able to watch that lineup since the night before Scott Walker's Blitzkrieg, because I happened to flip past Maddow, and I guess the story the day before he made his move was that there was a sign that he'd sent an email or a telegram to somebody claiming that he was ready to negotiate, and Maddow quite matter-of-factly proclaimed victory in Wisconsin and said, that one's over now, we've won that one. And then, of course, you know, the next morning he makes the move, and it just kind of underscored that they do what they do, right? I mean, a part of, you know, the line on that MSNBC, you know, left or pro-Democrat evening lineup is, of course, to cheerlead for whatever the Dems are doing, to give the sort of NPR plus kind of left of center types occasion to pat themselves, ourselves, on the back about they're being smarter than the Republicans are.
Yeah, well, stoking fear of Republicans seems even more their passion.
Right. No, it's absolutely right. But not fear that would actually sort of push people to develop something like a class critique, because what's the sin that the Republicans commit? Like, in addition to being crazy and stupid, it's overreach and being unreasonable, right? So I guess that's partly an expression of, well, of course, their own incoherent politics, but also I think that they do take their line ultimately from the Democrats who are in power, and that's kind of the critique the Democrats have of the Republicans also, right?
Well, and the Democrats couldn't ask for a better opposition.
No, from the looks of things, although, you know, I can imagine, I can hear Barney Frank saying, after Michelle Bachmann, our turn, which is just kind of scary, because we could wind up, I mean, as loony as those people are, I guess it's not out of the realm of the thinkable that we could wake up in The Handmaid's Tale one day. But I think the thing that concerns me most about this is not so much the TV personalities, although, you know, they are annoying in their own way, but what seems to be an inclination in the activist left, or, you know, which includes the labor movement, unfortunately, to view the population that's up for grabs, right, the social forces that we're trying to mobilize, as the version of public opinion or of the public that gets constructed as, you know, the audience that Maddow and O'Donnell and themselves consider themselves to be addressing, right? So for them, it's so what they see is a reasonable kind of American population out there that's folks, basically, but that's not working people, right? I mean, it's not the working class, for instance. That's and it just feels like a lot of, or to a significant extent, the effective political agency that's assumed by the kinds of actions and the kind of critiques and exposés that come out through the left blogosphere, through Amy Goodman, through, God forbid, The Nation, you know, and elsewhere, is this kind of mush or sort of inchoate public, right? Who we want to to whom we want to expose, you know, the Republicans having gone too far. And I guess the point I'm trying to get to with this is that underneath it all is this sense that the thing we've both complained about a lot over the years, that if the people just somehow knew, right, once they know, then the switch will be flipped, the lights will go on, the shackles will fall from their eyes, and they'll rise, and I guess they'll demand an end, you know, to winner-take-all elections and big money in politics, and then we'll win somehow.
But that kind of the showbiz liberal Democrat thing you're talking about has at least two problems I can think of, right? The one that by stoking fear of Republicans, it frees the base of actually having to articulate an agenda or organize anything. And at the top level, the Democratic leadership, starting with the guy in the White House, can be as conservative as they like to be without fearing any critique.
Well, you know, I mean, that's absolutely right. I was someplace or other out where I was on the one hand kind of pleased to see that MSNBC was the thing that was on in the lobby instead of Fox, which just goes to show that if you set the bar low enough, a pygmy can win the high jump. But I guess I shouldn't call them pygmies anymore. But I saw Melissa Harris Perry, I guess it is now, as a talking head about Obama's preparations for the 2012 presidential campaign. I think it was on O'Donnell's program, and he noted that while there are complaints from the left base of the Obama administration that the left has been done dirt and sold out through his compromises, that liberal Democrats are more solid in it, or those who identify themselves in public opinion polls as liberal Democrats are more solid in their support of Obama than moderate Democrats are, and I think that's probably true. And I think to the extent that it is true, I think it's an effect of exactly what you're talking about, right? So that, and I mean, this has kind of been what Obama's been from the very beginning, right? That the threshold, the limit of the left is support for Obama, basically. And that's exactly, I think that's exactly what the incessant stoking of fear of Republicans does, right? Like, it underscores there's no place else to go. And that deathless phrase we've been hearing now for, oh my God, probably getting closer and closer to three decades. Well, yeah, true, he's not worth anything, but the other guy's worse.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to hear a lot of that about a year from now. We're hearing some reservations about Obama coming from sort of left liberal Democrats, but a year from now, we're going to have to swallow all that and pull the lever because Michelle Bachmann or whoever, whatever horror they pick, is going to be so much worse.
Yep, that's right. That's it.
What's the way out of this?
Well, I'm feeling like a broken record about this, too. I mean, I was just emailing a friend of mine in Wisconsin, actually, who works for an education union, about this issue. I mean, the reality is, right, that these people are pretty terrible, and we can see the stuff. Yeah, we can see it in the stuff they're pushing through in every state where they have power now, and.
But we shouldn't forget that as bad as Scott Walker is, we've also got Cuomo in New York and Jerry Brown in California doing not dissimilar things.
Oh, no, absolutely, right? Right, that's absolutely correct. And, I mean, I've been saying for a while, too, even in print, so it can be traced, that I think in some ways one of the greatest travesties of the Obama administration, at least on the domestic front, is this hands-off policy that he studiously followed with respect to the fiscal crisis at the state level, because you knew that this kind of stuff was coming. You could see it, the storm clouds brewing one state after another.
Well, it was in the stimulus bill, but then that was the last consideration it got.
Oh, no, that's right. That's exactly right. And it's consistent with he's of course been acting in a way that's consistent with the political persona that he's crafted from the very beginning, which is not to stand for anything, not to push for anything, just to stand aloof and then to jump out in front of a consensus and to show that he's the guy who can bring all the stakeholders together. But, I mean, you're absolutely right that the Democrats are doing the same thing at the state level that the Republicans are doing, which makes you wonder about the recall. So what happens after we win the recall in Wisconsin, assuming that we do? But then, at the same time, it's going to be very difficult for public sector unions, for private sector unions, like six that there are remaining, to it's not reasonable to say, well, in the context of the presidential election or the congressional elections or the gubernatorial elections, where the differences between the Republicans and the Democrats in a practice that is apart from the rhetoric are only marginal, that's a waste of time to engage, or that you shouldn't engage, that you should boycott the elections, right? I mean, that's not practical. But what needs to happen is the same thing that's needed to happen all along, which is that in addition to doing that stuff, the left of center elements that have any real kind of institutional capacity should be putting something into trying to build an affirmative alternative around a left agenda, right? And this could be an opportunity in Wisconsin, for instance, like around the recall elections, right? Right. I mean, the organizing that's got to go on at the grassroots level or the base level to do these recall, to do the recall petitions could also, in principle, be a basis for trying to construct a real working class political agenda, right? To chart a way out of or through the fiscal crisis. Yeah, I don't know who's doing what in Wisconsin at this point. It would be interesting to find out if there are, some folks up there like Jim Kavanaugh, like, or some of the others who are trying to construct a real working class political agenda, within the constraints of having to operate like in one, one state. But the bottom line is, Doug, that until we can find a way to start trying to build an affirmative left force that's got its own legs, that's not dependent on trying to get to a constituency through Bill Maher and Rachel Maddow, then what's going to happen is the Democrats are going to get dragged farther and farther to the right, or are going to follow the Republicans more and more to the right, and things are just going to get worse and worse and worse. So it's like the basic experience we've had for the last 30 years.
I'm speaking with Adolf Reed, who's a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. But you mentioned organization and institutional presence, but a good deal of the intellectual left and even activist left has been disdainful of those things for quite a couple of decades now. We're talking about the reverence for spontaneity and leaderlessness has made people very skeptical about the kinds of things you're talking about.
Yes, and that's worked so well, hasn't it?
Beautifully. Well, we've just seen an instance of it in Egypt, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Yeah, which was a fascinating moment too. I mean, like, you could watch it, and I was kind of surprised at how far left the irrational exuberance went. I mean, there were a lot of people who I was surprised to see got their panties all wet about this stuff when it was clear from the very beginning. Well, yeah, all right. So Mubarak stepped down, and who pressured him to step down? And who picked the replacement? I believe it was the same military council that had been in power ever since Sadat. Since Nasser, right? So, what do you think is going to happen, right? There's no change in the regime on the domestic front, right? As important, as impressive, as well organized as the fight back was in Wisconsin, that also, by the way, the extent to which that was as impressive as it was, like, it's also an argument against spontaneity and the leaderlessness, because that the persistence of that effort required the level of organization that only an institution like the labor movement has the capacity to conduct and to sustain.
Well, it was forgotten, though, that in Egypt there were labor unions involved, so it didn't come exactly out of nowhere, but still they were greatly outmatched.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you look elsewhere around the region and you get a different story. But, to come back to the U.S. for a second, it struck me that much of the left press and, that includes like the chattering in the left academy focused much more on the fact of the mobilization than its actual potential to win in Wisconsin. A friend of mine who's a long-term trade union official made this point, too, that part of what had to be going on up there was preparation for how to try to build on the greater likelihood of defeat. And that's got to be a part of the story, too. But, even at the time that our side was cheering and wild-eyed about the successful mobilization, large-scale mobilization in Madison, we already knew what was going on in Indiana and Ohio and Florida, and it was striking even to somebody who has been sort of irked by this tendency in the left that you mentioned for a long time. Even it was still kind of striking to see how readily people who, again, you'd think would have known better, gave themselves over to wild exuberance and ungrounded optimism about. Wisconsin being the turning point. And I understand that this is kind of the Maddow line now too, that
And your friend Cornel West says there's a great democratic awakening afoot.
Oh, well, and there you go. As George McGovern said about John Connolly, I think, who made some snide crack about the Democrats after he switched parties, McGovern said, well, but then you consider the source. Well, I mean, one thing I've taken out of all this is a clearer understanding that the technical fix and the cargo cult are basically the same thing, right? Because each depends on a view of how change is made that assumes that some apocalyptic intervention, right, or some extraordinary intervention comes and does all the organizing work for you. Like it's either the coming of the Messiah or the appearance of a ship on the horizon bringing a fabulous cargo. It's the internet. It's a Daily Show, right? Or for that matter, it's the closer to nature, brown people who will lead us and show us the way, right? That's another version of this thing. Or it's getting off the grid. Or it's some other alternative to class struggle is what I guess I'm getting down to, right? I mean,
or growing your own food in your backyard.
Right. That's right. That'll do it every time.
Let's shift gears rather radically. Well, not so radically, because you just mentioned the people who are going to save us. But there's been a common thread in discourse, especially on the left, since the recession financial crisis happened, that the impacts have been disproportionate, that unemployment and foreclosure in particular have been felt by black and brown people much more than white people. Which of course is empirically true, but what are we to make of this politically?
Well, I think one of the most striking things to make of it politically is that people who make the claim keep assuming that you're making that point will either lead to some kind of remedial action that's unspecified, because they don't really have a causal point to make, right, except that, like the undefined sort of portmanteau kind of concept of racism, right, that accounts for the difference.
Well, now that racism is located, what, in the consciousness of white people?
Well, see, that's a problem, right? I mean, I think that's a problem, right? Because I think it's by and large not clear, and I mean, this is why, of course, as I've argued, as you know, that politics of anti-racism just kind of fails as a politics, because it's in kind of the same way that an anti-terrorism fails as a politics is because it doesn't have a real object, right? You can't find it anywhere. So I think one problem is that well, look, I mean, would anybody really expect to find anything different, right? And one kind of easy way to anticipate the finding is to start out by saying, well, okay, so blacks and other people of color tend to be poorer and less economically secure on the average than whites, and in deep economic recessions, people who are the most vulnerable get hurt worst, right? You can say the same thing about the subprime or the victimization by the subprime lending. In that area in particular, I mean, I've found, the way that the disparities or the findings of disparity have been discussed with respect to the housing crisis seem to come closest to implying kind of a devil theory of racism, right? That, because the implication seems to be that mortgage brokers targeted black people or Latinos to go take advantage of them because of something that's not usually described, but that seems to ring most closely to an insinuation, at least, that they were that the lenders were motivated by prejudice or bigotry or something like that. I think it'd be interesting, for example, to like some of the more sophisticated work, like a study by Myron Orfield did at the Institute for Race and Poverty at Minnesota. He makes a distinction between direct discrimination, as he describes it, and what we can see is kind of a neighborhood effect. And the argument goes kind of like this: that historically intensely segregated neighborhoods that had been victimized by redlining prior to passage of the Community Reinvestment Act still hadn't become, I guess a better way to put this, is that banks or the frontline banks who did the respectable mortgage financing still tended not to operate in those neighborhoods even after redlining was supposedly policed. And that created a space for the unregulated, non-bank lenders to come in and to hustle. And to that extent, the story is like the story that underlay the emergence of the horrible practice called contract selling that was common in Chicago in the 50s and 60s. So you could say that the peddlers of risky and disreputable instruments and practices were more likely to concentrate in these neighborhoods where people were less likely to have access to conventional mortgages, and they were less likely to have access and were vulnerable for reasons that had to do with both with economic inequality and with the history of redlining. You could call all that racism if you want to, right? And you could say that race is the characteristic that made people in those neighborhoods vulnerable and thus attractive as targets for the predatory lenders if you want to. But that doesn't explain very much, right? Calling it racism doesn't help us understand what the dynamics were and are that that produce and reproduce this kind of this kind of inequality. In the same way that saying race matters is a broad enough statement that both Charles Murray and who I saw, by the way, gave a State of White People talk at AEI on the anniversary of the King assassination Monday. But both Charles Murray and the aforementioned Cornel West could agree that race matters, but they'd mean diametrically opposite things, presumably, about what it means to say that race, the race matters. So in that sense, I think it'd be interesting to kind of, disaggregate the numbers, and this is what Merlin Chalkwanyan and I are trying to do now, to see how things look, for instance, in affluent black suburban enclaves, like in Prince George's County, Maryland, or the Southeast Atlanta burbs, or elsewhere, to see how the foreclosure rates and the percentage of or high risk mortgage instruments among blacks are in those areas, and in comparison to the to the national figures or to impacted inner city impacted inner city neighborhoods with a history of redlining. I'm also in cases where there are whites who live in historically black and Latino segregated areas that had a history of redlining. It'd be interesting to see how the exploitation in the mortgage lending process of those white people stacks up in comparison to the blacks and Latinos in those neighborhoods or the national sample. For that matter, how blacks live in upscale white neighborhoods that have no history of exposure to redlining or being on the wrong side of redlining, what their experience has been like. So that's one thing.
In other words, the neighborhood effect outweighs the melanin effect.
Yeah, it could. I mean, I think it's an interesting hypothesis to try to pursue.
Now, as you said earlier, like, saying race matters or pointing out the racial disparities in any kind of good fortune or bad doesn't really call forth any obvious remedy. But what function does that sort of thing serve then?
I think it serves a couple of ideological functions. I mean, one, the funders are quite interested in, right, which is the finding disparity and the call for further research, right? And in that sense, a function that it performs is that you can't read a policy proposal from it except for more funding for more of the research. So in that sense, it serves a political economic function because it feeds the disparities of the research industry. But but I think more than that, I think fundamentally its function is to insist on the centrality of race as the language through which we need to center the discussion of justice, injustice, inequality, race as contrasted to class. And more I'm getting to the point where I don't want to honor a race-class dichotomy at all, right, at least not in the empirical world. But I think the cut to the chase, I think that the most important political work that the insistence on the racial disparity as a focus does, and also a gender disparity, is to keep the race idea alive as the central point for orientation of a politics of aims to address inequality or injustice.
So then that would leave basically the, you know, just on paper, the statistical hierarchy of American society untouched, but just change the color of the cast of characters.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is a point that Walter Ben Michaels has made often. I mean, you can, and this, by the way, is also a notion that goes back really to and through the Black Power era, and I think you can trace it back to the, you know, to the end of the 19th century, and some of the early objections to the descending regime of Jim Crow at that point, which is that it doesn't make, you know, didn't make class distinctions, right, and that Black people who are capable of amassing property, of attaining upper class, you know, status, should be just as women, you know, shouldn't have those roots to the opportunity to excel, as they would see it, blocked by artificial and unjust prohibitions that are based on their ascriptive status as members of an inferior race or an inferior gender, right? So the punchline is that, you know, this, by the way, is an ideal of a just world that's perfectly consistent with a neoliberal order, right? Because as Walters often said, you can have a society in which 1% of the population controls 99% of the stuff, but as long as 12% of that 1% is Black and 14% is Latino and it's half women and whatever percentage should be gay or whatever the other protected classes are, then you would say it's a perfectly equal society.
So by removing the unnatural barriers, all the remaining inequalities are natural.
Exactly. And so the effect then is, once again, to naturalize market forces as they perceive them.
That was Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with a third indie gem, I Am a Tree, from 1997's album Mag Earwig by Guided by Voices. Till next week, bye. Stripped of it.